entire thing to me.
Does she have to be at school?
9:30, that's why I come in. Yeah, it starts at 9:30, but she...
Good morning. The meeting of the Health and Human Services Budget Division is called to order. We are going to continue today with an overview of the Department of Human Services budget structure. There's an agenda before you. We'll begin with the area of healthcare grants, and I would ask that Brian Osberg, Assistant Commissioner, proceed forward. Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Osberg, Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare, Department of Human Services. Our presentation begins on page 108. These pages review what's called Minnesota Healthcare Programs. There are three programs: medical assistance, which is our state Medicaid program, Minnesota Care, and General Assistance Medical Care. These programs serve more than 660,000 individuals, low-income families with children, pregnant women, elderly, and people with disabilities, including those in nursing homes. Now, distinguish this from long-term care and home and community-based services. You will hear about that in a different meeting. I'm referring to basic health services. Does not include the nursing home care services or home and community-based services. Now, medical assistance and Minnesota Care receive state and federal funding. In medical assistance, we get federal funding at 50%. That's the lowest possible. Some states, southern states, have 70-some percent federal money. We have 50%. And it's a function of a state's economic situation, poverty level. Minnesota Care, we also receive what's called the State Children's Health Insurance Program funding. This is federal funding. This year we'll have $48 million. Now, as I mentioned at our overview a couple of weeks ago, Minnesota developed a program for children before the federal government did, 10 years before the federal government did. And so we could not use the federal Children's Health Insurance Program for kids, so we use it for parents. I'll talk more about that later. Now, of course, the federal government is going to be reconsidering the reauthorization of the SCHIP program in this upcoming session. Now, 70% of our clients, about 435,000, are enrolled in managed care arrangements. And put simply, those clients who are families with children, adults with adult children, and the elderly are enrolled in managed care, and people with disabilities are in our own fee-for-service program, our own health plan. Now, there are some exceptions to that, and I'll talk about that in a second. Managed care organizations in this state, they're all nonprofit, as you know. We contract with health maintenance organizations. We also have four county-based managed care organizations that we contract with. One, Metropolitan Health Plan, is a subsidiary of Hennepin County. Those people that I refer to, those clients I refer to, are required to enroll into managed care. And the health plans, the managed care organizations that do business in the state, are required to participate and to serve our clients. Now, we have some voluntary arrangements, and I'll talk about that in a minute. We first implemented managed care in 1985. Now, this also includes, our arrangements also includes two demonstration projects. In fact, they're nationally recognized projects. One's called Minnesota Senior Health Options, and that's for people over 65 who are enrolled in both Medicare and Medicaid. We have about 35,000 enrollees in that program, and all nine managed care organizations that we work with participate in Minnesota Senior Health Options. Now, that was quickly developed the last couple of years because Medicare developed a program similar to that called special needs plans. And so all nine managed care organizations that we contract with participate in our Minnesota Senior Health Options arrangement. I've been very impressed in how quickly they came to be in position to serve those clients. Now, again, this is a voluntary option for people. They don't have to enroll into Minnesota Senior Health Options. If elderly don't enroll in Minnesota Senior Health Options, they have to enroll into our regular managed care arrangement called Minnesota Senior Care. But there has been some issues, certainly, working with counties, because some of the counties, of course, provided services and still do to those who are elderly. So the health plan has been working with the counties to make sure that this transition to MSHA, we call it, works well. And we have a committee with the counties, it's called a transitional committee, to make sure that does work well. Now, we also have something called Minnesota Disability Health Options. Again, this is a voluntary program for people with physical disabilities, and this is provided in the metropolitan area. We have only 700 and some clients enrolled in that program today. But that's where we integrate our health care services with our long-term care services, and we provide one point of contact for people in that program. Again, it's been nationally recognized and it's been well received by our clients and evaluation we've done. We also have a small pilot, managed care pilot, for developmentally disabled population in Hennepin, Scott, and Carver County. We only have 30-some people in the program today, whereby, again, we combine our health care services with our long-term care services. So we're in the process of developing some options for people with disabilities, managed care options. But, again, that population is not required to enroll in managed care. All other populations in our program, elderly, families with children, adults without children, are required to enroll in managed care. And those people who are in people with disabilities do receive services through what we call our fee-for-service arrangement, whereby we run our own health plan. And we pay the claims, for example, and we provide for management of pharmacy services and things of that sort. And we can get into that at some other time as to how we go about doing that. Now, if you turn to page 110, you will see that an idea as to the extent of the cost of our programs. In fiscal year 2007, if you look on the bottom of the current column, that's a total of $3.9 billion. Now, that's state and federal money. And as you can see, especially with the governor's recommendations, it goes up year by year. And the total under the governor's recommendation would be $9 billion for these programs. Again, I want to remind you that this does not include long-term care, the nursing home care side, or the home and community-based service waiver program. This just is what we call basic health services. Now, if you want to turn to within page 111, let me take you through Minnesota Care first. Minnesota Care, back in 2005, fiscal year 2005, we purchased health care for about 142,000 Minnesotans. That's come down to 129,000 on average in 2006. And most recent numbers that I've seen, I think it's November numbers, we have about 120,000 people enrolled in Minnesota Care. At its height, we had 150,000 people enrolled in Minnesota Care. And that was about 2002, 4 years ago, 5 years ago.
Just before we started wrecking it.
Minnesota Care provides coverage for low-income working families. It also provides for what we did back some time ago is disconnect the connection between being on our cash assistance programs and being in health care. You no longer, those people are all on our cash assistance program on MFIP, are automatically, of course, eligible for our programs. But we also want to make sure that other people be eligible for Minnesota Care arrangements, and so we disconnected that the eligibility requirement. And so people who are coming off of welfare, off of MFIP, are certainly eligible, of course, for Minnesota Care. And Minnesota Care is funded by a combination of things. Enrollee premiums, which is about 10% of the funding, 2% tax collected, what we call the provider tax, collected by hospitals, physicians, and other health care providers, and a 1% tax on insurance premiums. This is called the Health Care Access Fund. And you may have received statements regarding the status of the health care access. And we have a surplus projected in the next few years of about $165-180 million, something like that. I forget the number offhand. This also includes, as I said, the state children's health insurance program. Now, if you look at A12, back in the green section, it gives you an idea as to who's eligible for Minnesota Care. green section of your, in the back of your book, gives you an idea as to, and the way we structured this graph is that we did by families and children, adults without children, and age blind and disabled. But if you look at the Minnesota Care column under families and children, you can see that children and pregnant women with household income up to 275%. And if you look at also A10 has the federal poverty guidelines. And gives you an idea as to what the federal poverty guideline is for certain percentages. So 275% is the top end for children and pregnant women, but also for parents. And then you get an idea then if you look at Minnesota Care site on adults without children, you see the top end for coverage is 175% of poverty guideline. Now, we also have certain barriers, if you will, insurance barriers in our program as well, to make sure that there's not a crowd out of private coverage. And those include the fact that if individual's employer has coverage that contributes more than 50% towards the cost of that coverage, they would not be eligible for Minnesota Care. If somebody has access to what's called continuation coverage or COBRA coverage, if they left their employer and have access to maintaining that coverage up to 18 months, they're not eligible for Minnesota Care. They're not eligible for Minnesota Care if they've had insurance coverage in the last 4 months. These provisions have been put in place over the years to prevent people from moving from private coverage into Minnesota Care, into public coverage. We also introduced, as 2011, an asset limit for people in Minnesota Care. It's $10,000 for one individual and $20,000 for two. And just like in our medical assistance program, we exempt certain things like homestead, car, and a burial fund. Now, if you look at back on page 112, you get an idea as to the services that are covered under Minnesota Care. And that's detailed even more in other graphs you have in the back. And it varies. Coverage in Minnesota Care varies based on an individual situation and whether or not they're adult without children or they're a child or if they're a parent. And so we have different programs within Minnesota Care. It's not just one program and one set of benefits. I think we have, I don't know, maybe six or seven different categories of Minnesota Care. And you get an idea by looking on pages 111 what kind of services are covered in Minnesota Care. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Premiums are charged to everyone that enrolls in Minnesota Care. The lowest is $4 a month for a child under 150% of poverty. And the high end could be as high as $447 a month when you're at the 275% of poverty. And so the premiums that are charged in Minnesota Care are based on income. It's a graduated scale. And it goes up the top end, up to 275%. It's roughly 9.8% of income is what the premium equals. And as I said, the bottom end is $4. Now, there's also a number of people who are in Minnesota Care who are probably eligible for medical assistance. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. Some have already moved to medical assistance. And for various reasons, they've enrolled in Minnesota Care and not medical assistance. That's same with general assistance medical care. There's a number of people in Minnesota Care that are eligible for general assistance medical care but have opted to stay in Minnesota Care. Now, let me give you a little history quickly about Minnesota Care and what did happen in 2003. The Children's Health Plan was enacted back in 1988. Minnesota Care then came and expanded Children's Health Plan in 1992 and gradually increased eligibility. And as I said, now up to 275% of poverty is in the top end for families and for pregnant women and children. In 2003, benefits for adults without children with income over 75% of poverty were limited and capped at $5,000 a year. That cap was lifted in 2005, and diabetic supplies and equipment and mental health services were added. We still have a limited benefit set, though, for the population, adults without children, between 75% and 175%. It's limited in what services, what providers are available to serve that population. Also in 2003, parents who earn more than $50,000 are no longer eligible for Minnesota Care. And we, as I said, we established asset limits in 2003. Then we went from a 12-month review, eligibility review, to 6 months, beginning in 2003 as well. And then we had, for both medical assistants and Minnesota Care, we had before 2003 something called auto newborn coverage. That is, for an infant up to age two, they're automatically eligible for coverage to age two. That was brought down to age one in 2003 for both Minnesota Care and medical assistants. And we made some other changes as well, as Madam Chair referenced. If you look at page 115, you get an idea as to what kind of funding is involved in Minnesota Care. And you look at the bottom line, you can see also, based on what's being recommended, where the funding would go under the governor's recommendations as to how much is spent. Now, this also includes the federal money, both the Medicaid money and the SCHIP money is included in this. And this also includes, this does not include, of course, the premiums are paid by the individuals enrolled in Minnesota Care.
Does not
include the premiums paid by individuals enrolled in Minnesota Care. This is just the state and federal funding for health, for the health care, for Minnesota Care. Again, I assume that perhaps the health care access fund projection is in the book at some point. I imagine you can look at an idea as to what's available in that.
When we get fiscal notes involving Minnesota Care, we will see an entire spreadsheet so that we will get an idea of all the categories for that program.
Now, I'll move on to medical assistance, unless there are any questions around Minnesota Care at this point. Then I refer you to page 122. And in our budget, we separate medical assistance, basic health services, from families and children, from elderly and disabled. So I'm going to go over families and children's medical assistance funding first. Page 122.
Maybe we could just stop and see if there are any questions so far. Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry I didn't realize we were jumping to the next section. I was looking at just something my eye caught on page 116 under the background. It says, although Minnesota is ranked the healthiest state in the nation, the state has the lowest uninsurance rate in the country. Could you just talk about that for a minute? Because, you know, you hear all sorts of claims floating around. And I have heard, in fact, that we're one of the healthiest states in the nation. What would that be based on? But then I've also heard exactly the opposite, that we have the highest rate of insured population in the nation. And that is an exact opposite of this. So,
well, Madam Chair, Senator Ropes, that is our budget page that we'll talk about next time, perhaps. That's what we call a change page. That's the governor's recommendation, and we can discuss that in length. But to your question, yes, we do have the lowest uninsured rates in the country. And the uninsured rate is calculated by different ways. And calculation, no matter how we calculate it, I guess, we have the lowest uninsured rate. And right now it's over 7%. It has grown, though, in the last few years. We had an uninsured rate that was lower than 7.3%, I think is the number. And the health department tracks this. And they track it with the help of the University of Minnesota research. Now, in terms of the healthiest state, that's measured through various tools. United Health Group has a tool to measure that. There's other measurements of health status, and it's true that most measures we are either sometimes we're ahead of Hawaii, sometimes right behind Hawaii. It all depends, I guess, but we are measured as one of the healthiest states and that's measured by everything from health status to uninsured rate to other factors. A number of factors goes into that, and so that is the case.
I believe that Hawaii is ahead of us in their rate of insurance, number of insured people in their state.
Madam Chair, we have to need to check with the health department on that. I think that goes back and forth. All depends, again. Some people measure uninsurance over the course of time. Whether or not you were uninsured during a period of time, the way we measure it here, the health department, is a point in time. Are you uninsured today? Based on that, I think we are the lowest in the country. But I think the health department can provide that answer to you. And then on page 122 begins, as I said, what we call the basic health care grants for families and children. And we purchased preventive and primary health care services for 336,000 people in 2005 and 348,000 in 2006. Now, this acts as our health care safety net for lowest-income Minnesotans, and we provide coverage for up to 3 months retroactively for people who enroll into Minnesota to medical assistance. Now, medical assistance is administered by counties exclusively, and also is based on, of course, state and federal guidelines. Now, this also includes the Minnesota Family Planning Program, which started this past summer, July of 2006, under a federal waiver. And eligibility is determined right now by state staff, and eventually it will be determined also by county staff when we have the eligibility system automated to the point in which the counties can handle this additional responsibility.
Assistant Commissioner, when will that be?
Madam Chair, the timetable for right now is that we will be testing the system called Health Match later this year, and in late 2008, we would have it fully implemented across the state.
Are you sure?
Madam Chair, we continue to assess that situation, and at times we're not sure. Nothing is completely sure with the process of that magnitude. And we will provide an update to you certainly during this next month, as it may affect the forecast. So we continuously assess the timing by which the eligibility system will be up and running for this program.
Assistant Commissioner, how many times has this program been delayed?
Madam Chair, the program has never been delayed.
Well, the expected start date has been delayed.
Expected start delay has been delayed. That has been, I think, the initial date of completion, I would say, was 2007. I want to say March of 2007. I believe that was expected earlier this year, was the initial date.
So it's been delayed several times.
It has been. Madam Chair, has been delayed. Well, it has been delayed until, as I said, the fall of 2008.
2009? And one of the reasons that this is important for the members to understand, and I'm just underscoring it a little bit, is because there can be no changes made in our programs unless we purchase workarounds. There can be no changes made until after Health Match is up and running, unless we purchase workarounds of the system that are done manually.
Madam Chair, we're providing assessment that you will receive as to what we can do potentially with our current structure, our current systems, what we call MMIS and MAXIS, which is what our programs are currently managed on. So we will give you an assessment in the near future as to what options may be available in terms of managing any and implementing any major changes to our programs.
How many of the changes that the legislature's made so far are on hold waiting for the computer health match system to be implemented?
Madam Chair, none that I'm aware of.
I guess most of the workarounds that we've paid for never became law. But I expect that's...
But Madam Chair, the one exception...
...change this year, maybe.
The one exception is, as I said, in the family planning piece, is that the county's involvement in the family planning program in terms of administering eligibility has been delayed because of the delay of Health Match. That's the only situation that I'm aware of.
Assistant Commissioner, so what is the delay in processing family planning applications for Medicaid?
Madam Chair, we've had for some time the difficulty of managing applications for our programs because of various reasons. One is because the system is not automated, and we certainly need an automated system, obviously, to make this work more effectively. We've also had added complexity to our programs in terms of eligibility provisions, especially. Not only has the state added complexity to the programs, but so has the federal government with its changes through legislation that was enacted a year ago. So that has added a great deal of complexity to our program. We've also resources at the county level and the state level in terms of managing eligibility have been strained. And another thing that we need to do is that we're in the process of doing is thinking through how to redesign how we do eligibility for our programs, what role the county plays and what role the state plays in more effectively and more efficiently determining eligibility. Right now, the system is not working. We realize that. And so we have delays in all of our programs, not just the medical assistance, in terms of processing applications that we want to fix, certainly. What's the critical piece of that is that we have to have a automated system, and we're going to make sure that the system that we developed, this health match system, works well before we introduce it. The state of Colorado had a disaster after putting a couple $100 million into an automated system. It didn't work. We're going to make sure. And also, I understand the need for us to be in a position to implement any changes the legislature has. We take that very seriously. And as I said, we're assessing potential options around doing that. But we're going to make sure that the system that we're counting on here, which we still have a lot of confidence in, that it works well. And we're not going to introduce it to the counties and to our own state operations, eligibility determination operations, until we know it works well. And that's...
Assistant Commissioner, I don't think you answered my question. You gave us a lot of reasons why you're having trouble, but the basic question was, you know, how long is it taking to process a family planning Medicaid application?
Madam Chair, right now it takes on average about 45 days. 45, I think it's 45 to 50. 50 days, 45 to 50 days.
We've been hearing that people are not getting processed even within the 3-month look back period.
I'll
describe this a little more clearly for some of our new members. A person comes into a family planning clinic, and that is the point at which an application is filled out. Services are provided, and the clinic should have a reason to believe that that application will be processed within 3 months. And then there is a look-back period in Medicaid where they'll pay for services that were incurred within 3 months of the application being finalized. But what we're hearing is that the family planning applications are not being processed within the 3-month period, which then means that that service that was provided at that visit is not paid for.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, I'm Kathy Henry from the Department of Human Services, and the family planning program is under or within my division. I just have a few corrections or clarifications to make. First of all, there's not retroactive coverage in the family planning program. There's a presumptive eligibility period that begins on the day the applicant or the client is seen in the clinic. That application is sent to us via fax, or I believe it's coming in a fax form. And we're approving the presumptive eligibility the same day, within 24 hours. They'll get presumptive usually within the same day. The problem or the difficulty we're having is one that maybe can't be solved, but I can explain that too. The presumptive eligibility period that was approved by CMS is anywhere from 30 to 60 days. And it depends on when you apply in a month. So if you applied this month, let's do February 28th, you are entitled to a presumptive period that begins in the month of February. So if you've used up your entire February date, and then you're permitted one additional month, so you get the month of March. Well, then you only have a 31-day presumptive eligibility period. And by law, even if we were processing within 45 days, it may take us more than 31 days to process the application. The logical correction or fix to that would be to ask CMS to give us longer presumptive eligibility periods. And what we're finding right now is the states, upon request for renewal of their family planning programs or grants, are being denied presumptive eligibility completely. So we're very nervous about asking for more than we already have because we believe we're fortunate that we have what we have. And the other solution is to hire more staff, and we are looking at reallocating staff from other areas within my division to increase the number of people that are working on family planning program. They are processing several thousand applications, and they did get ahead of us at the onset. We were kind of surprised by a level of activity. We've made a great deal of progress. We were quite behind within the first month, and we're caught up on backlogs. Right now, it's just a matter of trying to keep up with the ongoing eligibility. We're also working with the family planning providers because we're having some difficulty with understanding of the program. Last month, we denied about 1,400 applicants because they had not provided the things we needed in order to establish eligibility for them. So there's some wrinkles to work out, and we're working diligently with the providers. We just met with Planned Parenthood yesterday and have had several other meetings with the community to try and work out the wrinkles and get this program working as well as we'd like it to.
Are there questions on this? Senator Lynch?
Just a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to say that I appreciate the line of questioning here because I think among members at this table, certainly that there's been a lot of dialogue and discussion in the last months and regarding administrative costs and healthcare reform, and I would look to the department certainly to be a leader in this area for us. And it seems like there are a number of times that we are talking about administrative processes that need to be streamlined that I think that the department can and should certainly take a real leadership role in this. And so I just would be supportive of any efforts along those lines and appreciate the question.
Okay, thank you. Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't really have a question, just a comment. I just want to say how, I guess, disgusted I am that I don't feel like we're getting straight answers on the health match. And, I guess I do have a question of what can we do here at the legislature to make sure that this is sped up. I mean, don't you have enough people? Isn't there enough people? Or what seems to be the problem? I guess I'm concerned about something that I've been working on that the chair knows about, the eligibility requirements for Minnesota Care on farmers. And let's say hypothetically that passed. So then we're saying July 1st of 2007, which is a few months away, We would not be able to implement that until 2008 because Health Match would not be ready.
Madam Chair, Senator Corey, it's not Health Match is not the issue there in that case. Any system changes that we need to make will take some time. So even under the current structure that we have, as I said, we have systems that support eligibility today. Even under those current systems, we'd have to make changes. So you need some time to do that. We could not possibly implement a change that passed in May by July 1st of 07. There's very few changes that
usually we can make. It would be in the next January.
Yes. And in some cases, all depends on the nature of the change that can be done. Now, the question is, the issue around Health Match is, do we wait until we make these changes and implement them when Health Match comes up so that we automate it? Or do we change work on the current systems and change those first, which delays then the Health Match project further because of resource needs? So anytime we change our current system, MMIS and MAXIS system, that delays further what, because our people working have to work on both systems. That delays further than the Health Match project. And that's the issue, is whether or not we can afford and should delay Health Match in order to implement certain programs immediately. And that's something we need to talk about together. And we're willing to do that. As I said, we are willing to have a discussion around how we can accomplish that. But it may cause further delay in the automation of our eligibility system, thus having error rates that we had today, which are unacceptable, thus having the inconsistency we have in terms of determining eligibility across the counties. And at some point, we got to get to this issue. So at some point, we have to automate our eligibility system. And we realize that people want to make changes in the program now, as soon as possible. We understand that. So we're trying to accommodate both of these ideas, both of these objectives. And that's the challenge, the management challenge that we have. And I think we're very upfront about that. We've been very upfront, and it reflects in our fiscal notes exactly what it takes in order to make some of these changes. We have very careful assessment of these situations when they're presented to us.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Madam Chair, thank you. Assistant Commissioners, I think everyone appreciates how difficult it is to move a large system, you know, through transition of change. But I guess I would echo Senator Coring's question, is it that you need more staff to do that? And sometimes, you know, when you're trying to turn the ship, you need, you know, if I can get too nautical here, all hands on deck, you know, on one side, and you need a lot more people, you know, getting the change made so that we can get more quickly to the legislative and policy changes that we want to see happening on the street. Because one of the frustrations that we all come with is that people come to us back home with great needs and, you know, in, you know, very personal life situations. And we come up here and write policy that we think is going to help. And it's really frustrating for me to go back home, and I have people hanging on by their fingernails, and then to say, it's going to be ready in a year and a half. You know, they're going to be down the financial drain by that time. So, you know, we want to get the safety net or these opportunities out there to people much more quickly. So is there a way, again, I guess I would ask Mr. Corn's question, that we can help this change come about more quickly?
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson Ropes. Yes, potentially. I think one thing that we're looking at is what additional resources will we need, and we'll share that with you in order for this to happen. In order for you to accomplish what you want to do, what will it take? We'll give that information to you in the form of a fiscal note analysis. That
wait till you see them, my dear.
Oh.
Assistant Commissioner,
thank you.
How much has been spent on Health Match so far, and what was it originally budgeted at?
Madam Chair, the cash outlay so far is $7.9 million. The budget for this is $22.5 million, roughly $23 million. And
what was it originally budgeted at?
Originally, I believe it was $16 million. It was the original budget. We still believe that it's, that part of it is a very fair fair value in terms of the transaction.
So you're not anticipating that it's going to be more than the one increase before it's implemented?
Madam Chair, I can't commit to that at this point. We're assessing with our vendor what all it's going to take for us to come to conclude. What we did in part is broaden the scope of this as well. We realized that at first we're going to just do families and children in terms of eligibility, but that we realized that that would not necessarily get us where we need to be. So we wanted to add elderly and disabled to this. We're also, we didn't anticipate the complexity change, what happened the last few years in terms of changes federal government and as the state as well. So we need to build that in. We need to assess that. At this point, I cannot commit that we'll not have a change. We're obviously trying to manage this the best we can financially, and we will let you know if a financial change does take place.
One last question about delays in eligibility. What is the turnaround time now for a Minnesota Care application in your department?
It's roughly 3 months at this point. We can discuss that issue further if we want to.
And what does the statute require the turnaround to be?
Why don't you explain?
Madam Chair, Kathy Henry again. The turnaround time, the 3 months is actually how long it generally takes to become enrolled in Minnesota Care. The actual number of days that occur between the time an application is picked up and it's processed is about 48 days, and that's the back and forth between the applicant and the person that's managing the application. So it's another indication of how difficult the program has gotten. It's no longer likely that anyone is able to submit an application form with all the requested verifications and have eligibility determined on the day the application is received, which is what we used to be able to do years at the very beginning of the program. Today, if somebody gets assistance, they might be able to do it, but things like citizenship verification have certainly lengthened the application process, and as I mentioned, it's an average of 45 to 48 days, and that's from the time that we get the application, we send out a notice for what additional information we need. They return it, sometimes not complete, sometimes not everything we need. We make a second request, and then they respond to the second request. And we do have better tracking systems now, so we can determine where the flaws or the weaknesses are in the program, and that definitely is one of them, is the complications of the program. The program just having many facets as well as verification, different citizenship verification, I think, is by far the most cumbersome process that we've added, and that's a federal requirement that we couldn't avoid. 3 months is how long it takes, because by the time we determine eligibility in 45 to 48 days, we still have to notify the applicant of the amount of their premium, and they need to respond with that payment. So typically it will take the third month after you apply will be the first month you can enroll in the program. At our best, it's going to be the second month after you apply because of the premium requirements.
And if we simplify the application form, will that help reduce the amount of time that it would take for you to process it?
Madam Chair, that's an excellent question. One of the difficulties that we've encountered over the years of Minnesota Care is the application form itself. And the reason it was lengthened recently is in response to county financial workers, Minnesota Care enrollment reps, clients who, with a shortened application, were not producing or providing as much information as we needed to do an eligibility determination. So if we have a shorter application and ask fewer questions, it just means that when we get the application in the office, we have more questions that we need to ask them. And the turnaround time lengthened with the shorter application form. I really don't see a solution other than having fewer rules.
Well, that is the idea of a simplified application, is to reduce the number of requirements that people have to jump through to become eligible.
But, Madam Chair, the state can do just so much, too. There's a lot of federal requirements that we have to.
We understand there are some federal requirements that we can't change, but there are some state requirements that could be changed.
And, Madam Chair, one thing we're looking at is we have one combined application because it, in some cases a family is looking at different programs for their, you know, medical assistance or Minnesota Care. We have long-term care application. We have the same application for kids. In some cases, of course, the 44 questions we have in the application, some are not even applicable, and some people just skip over because it doesn't apply to them. The question is whether or not we break this up and have a kids application, have a long-term care application. Now, that gets back to the problem, again, of making sure that people have ability to understand that they may be eligible for various programs. So we're looking at what can we do to make this easier. Now, some states have just reduced the size of the print. Well, I'm not sure what that does in helping things. And so I don't know. That's not the answer. The answer is what you said, addressing some of the criteria, some of the requirements we have in statute.
Are there other questions? Sandra Olson.
Commissioner, Madam Chair, I'm wondering how many other states already have a program, an automated program like Health Match in place, and of those states, is there something we could borrow to move this around, or are we totally trying to reinvent the wheel? And then I guess my final question is, in comparison to those states, if you know, how long did it take them to implement this type of program, which might give us an idea whether, you know, we're moving along at a rate that's reasonable to expect?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, and Mr. Woods, you can correct me if you would, but I'm not aware of any state that has done this to this magnitude. There's some states that are trying to do it at the same time. Massachusetts and Wyoming are trying to do this, and they're encountering some of the same issues in terms of delays. You have to understand, we have 16,000 eligibility rules in our system. Frankly, we underestimated back in 3-4 years ago the magnitude of this task. No doubt about it, we realized there's a lot of complexity to this, but we got into the specifics in trying to automate something like this and program something like this and encode, you know, software. It became an incredible task. And so we have, in fact, with other states, we have a user group working with the same vendor to talk about some of these things. So we're sharing some of the information with each other. But, Mr. Woods, are you aware of any other states who have completed the task?
Madam Chair, members, excuse me. I don't think I'm infectious. My name is Larry Woods, Department of Human Services. In Minnesota, to my knowledge, is the first state that's come up with a focused health care eligibility determination system. There have been efforts in other states. You've heard about Colorado and Texas. Those were three-digit implementations. And when I say three-digit, I mean 100 million implementations. And they came up too quickly. They focused on time, not quality. And if you've heard about Colorado, they were basically a failure. And that isn't going to happen in Minnesota. We're going to focus on quality. We're working with our county customers to ensure that the implementation that we bring in here meets their needs. As Commissioner Osberg indicated, Minnesota is moderately unique in its complexity. We have over 100 major programs in our systems, and from our perspective, a major program defines an eligibility set and a benefit set, 100. And in order to break that 100 major programs down into an eligibility determination engine, it is going to take the 16,000 rules. What you have right now are 2,500 county financial workers trying to run through this gauntlet of eligibility determination decisions, trying to apply those eligibility rules. The Health Match Project will automate that process in a web-based environment. The rules-driven engine will run those decisions. And we have experienced delay. We acknowledge that. But our focus, again, is still on the quality of the implementation. Our focus is on increasing the speed of the eligibility determination process and lowering the program integrity concerns, because right now when the federal government completes their performance error rate measurement program focusing on eligibility, Minnesota and other states are going to be at risk without a system like this. So yes, other people have tried, they haven't been successful, and I assure you we will be successful.
Other questions on this? I am feeling I need to move on here. Let's do that then.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I turn page 122 again to continue on the Families and Children Healthcare Grant Program. If you look once again at A12, back in your green section of your book, you'll see the eligibility chart. And for families and children, you'll see that we cover, again, pregnant women up to 275% of poverty, infants up to age 2 at 280% of poverty. And that's because in order to secure our SCHIP money, the Federal Children's Health Insurance Program money, our standard for infants have to be a little bit higher than our standard for children. Our standard for children is 275 under Minnesota Care, as I talked about earlier. Medical assistance covers kids up to age 18 at 150% of poverty. At one point, we had 170% of poverty on the books, but that never was enacted. That was repealed the year after. And then kids, if you will, children 19 and 20 are 100% of poverty. The asset limits for adults, except for pregnant women, is the same as Minnesota Care. So you can see under medical assistance and families and children that we have different standards depending on the person's status. And you go back to page 122, and you see, again, what services we cover and what co-pays we have in place for families and children. We don't have co-pays for children. And in fact, other groups are exempt from the co-pays as well, but I'll get into that later on. But if you go back to those pages, you see what services we do cover. Now, the federal government requires that state medical assistance or Medicaid programs cover certain services, and they also give an option to cover others. We, by and large, picked up all those options. We cover most every service that is available in terms of covering people on medical assistance. And you can see on page 122 what co-payments we have in place. And those were enacted in 2003. Now, of course, the history of this program goes back to when Medicaid was enacted back in 1965, and we've been participating ever since. And the SCHIP program, this is kind of captured on page 123. The SCHIP program was enacted in 1999. As I mentioned before, we use it for parents between 100 and 200% of poverty. Let me turn now to page 125, unless there's any questions on the basic health care grants for families and children. And I'll turn to elderly and disabled next.
I think it's important for people to understand the reason our SCHIP money comes for parents is because we already had implemented Minnesota Care and gotten federal waivers for Medicaid for the children. And then when SCHIP was passed at the federal level, they said you could not convert any child on Medicaid to SCHIP. SCHIP has a higher matching rate with the federal government than the 50%. So eventually we convinced the federal government that we were one of those situations where no good deed ever goes unpunished, and we got them to agree that we should not be shut out of the SCHIP program, and they agreed that we could use the SCHIP for our parents.
And Madam Chair, we do maximize the SCHIP that's available to us, even though it goes towards parents. So we have a situation where we make sure we absorb all the money available to us. Some states have not been able to do that. And the money's been sent back to Washington.
Yes. Madam Chair, I've been involved in some meetings at the national level where there's been some resistance to continuing to fund adults under the SCHIP program. And I was wondering if there's any possibility can you transfer the SCHIP to children and then some other funding to adults?
Not in our case. We couldn't under the federal law would have to be changed. But I thought it was that the federal government was not approving new state applications for adding parents to SCHIP.
There, Madam Chair, I'm hearing that there's a lot of lobbying going on to remove those funds from states that use it for adults and to redistribute them to states that could use it.
Madam Chair, Senator Brentner Solon, we will track that. I'm not aware of that. I've not heard that. I'll ask our Medicaid director whether or not that has been discussed, but that would be concerning, certainly. There has been resistance to use it for adults without children. They've been very clear about that, but not because this is part of our waiver that we received in 2005 that goes into 2008. So I would, we'll double check that. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions on this?
Then page 125 is the financials, is to get an idea as to how much is spent in terms of families and children, for both federal, if you look at the bottom line, both federal and state dollars. Again, 50% is federal money. Then turn to page 127, where we go over our basic health care grants for elderly and disabled. We purchase health care for about 53,000 elderly, defined as 65 and older, and 94,000 people with disabilities. And we also help low-income Medicare recipients pay for their Medicare copays. And if they're above, as I said, we have 100,000 clients who are both on Medicare and Medicaid, but we also have some low-income Medicare people that we help pay for their copayments. And it's oftentimes we buy in, what we call buy into Medicare, so that they have full Medicare coverage. We pay for the premiums on that. And so that then Medicaid wraps around their Medicare coverage. That's how that works. And again, just like the Families and Children's Program, eligibility is managed by counties. And we're facing some of the same challenges that we talked about earlier regarding eligibility management. Now, again, going back to A12, elderly and people with disabilities are eligible at or below 100% of poverty. Now, they also can be eligible for coverage through what's called a medical spend down. If they spend down the difference between their income and 75% of the federal poverty guideline, then we'll provide coverage for them as well. So they don't have to necessarily have income that is below 100%. But they have to spend down, meaning they have to incur expenses on a regular basis that would be the difference between their income and 75% of the federal poverty guideline. And so people that way don't lose all their income and still be eligible for medical assistance. It's a program, it's a very important aspect of our program to help people get coverage even though they're not eligible otherwise in terms of their income. Explain that well enough for people, because that's an important. Now, that's been in place for some time. We also, the asset limits for people who are elderly and disabled are $3,000 for a single person and $6,000 for a couple. Now, this does not include, again, homestead, a car, or a burial fund. And again, the medical assistance coverage can be retroactive to 3 months, back to 3 months before the application.
And of course, if you look at the chart, the 75% of poverty for an individual who would be elderly or disabled is $639 a month. It's not much money.
We also have a program called MAEPD, Medical Assistance for Employed Persons with Disabilities, again, allowing for people with disabilities to have an income that exceeds the income standard, yet have medical assistance coverage. This provides for, of course, an incentive for people to maintain their work status. Now, this is for people between ages of 16 and 65. There is a $20,000 asset limit in this case. And they do pay a premium to that program as well. And we have about 6,600 enrollees in this program. Very helpful, certainly, for people who want to continue to work. And that's been
usually
in place.
Usually it's go back to work because they have to have been declared disabled to get in this program by Medicare. In order to be declared disabled by Medicare, usually you have to have been unemployed.
In most cases, that is the case, Madam Chair. And then, again, the benefits, the services, and co-pays are detailed in pages 127 and 128 in terms of what is covered. Same thing here as in families and children. We exercise all of, in essence, all of the options that the federal government allows us to cover. For example, prescription drugs is an option to states. It's not a requirement for states. Certainly, we cover prescription drugs. We also cover dental care and other services. And you can see the co-payments here as well. Now, the next, let me give a little bit of history, I guess, about this. Of course, Medicaid was started in 1965, and we began participation in 1966. And as I said, we added MA EPD in 1999. And you can see on page 131 the kind of expenses that are associated with this program. And the current column, $1.6 billion. Again, just to remind you, this does not include the nursing home or the home and community-based services costs. You'll see that on a different page. And then, unless any other questions, I'll turn to general assistance medical care.
Let's keep going.
Okay. Page 138. In general assistance medical care, for people without dependent children between ages of 21 and 64, this is completely state-funded. The federal government has not provided, through their Medicaid program, any funding for people who are without children during this age group between 21 and 64. And, again, back in A12, you can see the general assistance medical care poverty guideline is 75% of the guideline. And we do have coverage for people between 75 and 175% in a program eligible for what's called general assistance hospital only. If they have a situation where they're hospitalized, and then there's coverage for them during that hospitalization, including physician services, if they're between 75 and 175. Now, again, remember, they also have, that population has the ability to participate in Minnesota care as well. But if they're not in Minnesota care and they're in a situation and they're not eligible for general assistance medical care because their income is above 75% of the poverty guideline, then they're eligible for this hospital-only program. And that's really to take care of an acute episode. And so coverage is very short-term in a situation like that. There's been a very few people that have been taking advantage of that program, but by and large, it really helps hospitals who have somebody come into their hospital who otherwise can't afford to pay, and they're not on one of our programs. And so hospitals, there's a source of reimbursement for the hospitals in that situation and the doctors providing coverage to them. Now, again, the services and co-pays for general assistance medical care is detailed on page 138. You can again, we have a pretty comprehensive set of services in general assistance medical care. As I said, the hospital-only program is very, very limited. We have higher co-payments in some cases for people in general assistance medical care, especially for eye exams and also in restorative dental. Otherwise, and also there is not retroactive coverage for people in general assistance medical care. As I said, for medical assistance, you can go back 3 months from the date of the application to have coverage. In general assistance medical care, that's not the case. It's the date of the application is when that coverage would begin.
Yes, Senator.
You're still talking about this general hospital coverage?
That is on an episode basis, general hospital. I'm talking about general assistance medical care in general. Is not you're not eligible retroactively for that coverage.
So, Madam Chair.
Well, you're not retroactively eligible for the hospital care either. You have to fax an application to the department on the day of admission to be.
You, ha- Madam Chair, right, you have to, in essence, enroll in that in the day of admission. There's ways we facilitated that enrollment, but that's true.
And the reason we used to have retroactivity is because when you're in the middle of a healthcare crisis, sometimes it's kind of hard to get the financial information from the patient that might be needed to make
an
application.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's the limitation I see in this
Well, it was part of the 2003 budget cuts. It didn't used to be that way.
It's a problem.
We didn't used to have a hospital-only program either. We used to have a higher eligibility for the full general assistance medical care program.
Yeah, we used to have, Madam Chair, we used to have the spend-down arrangement you referring to. Right. General Assistance Medical Care started in 1976, so it's 30 years old. Starting in 1991, we relieved the counties of their share of the cost. In fact, they also had a share at one point in medical assistance. Right now, the non-federal share is completely state money. Now, of course, as you know, the counties provide services and finance those services, other health care services in other ways. But in this case, in terms of our programs, there's no county share any longer. That was eliminated some time ago. Now, speaking in 2003, in terms of changes that took place that impacted general assistance medical care, the spend down was eliminated, and as Madam Chair just said, it was replaced by the hospital-only piece. And the retroactive coverage was also eliminated. We also eliminated coverage for undocumented non-citizens, and there were about, if I recall, approximately 2,000 people affected by that change. Now, undocumented non-citizens are eligible for emergency medical assistance, but you have to have what's called a Medicaid status. In other words, you have to be a child or a person who's elderly or a person with a disability. So adults without children do not have coverage through either general assistance medical care or through emergency medical assistance. However, pregnant undocumented women are covered in our program through a different program. And so that's the two exceptions then in terms of covering people who are not citizens or are undocumented is through emergency medical assistance and cases of pregnant women who are undocumented. And then getting this past year, we began the process based on earlier legislation, to shift some people from general assistance medical care to Minnesota care. It's called transitional Minnesota care. Some people otherwise would not fit into that category of Minnesota care are still in general assistance medical care. So you can see the numbers come down in terms of number of people. Right now we have roughly 39,000 enrollees in general assistance medical care. That number will come down a little bit as they transition over to Minnesota care. But example, people with ESRD or people who are on the chemical dependency treatment fund, some people are exempt from that transition. But you can see, that's why you're going to see in the forecast, you see some reduction in general assistance medical care as we transition, if you will, that program.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon.
Why would some people be exempt from that transition, Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, it would not fit well for them. In some cases, it's just that they would not be positioned to enroll into an insurance type of arrangement. Minnesota Care is more of an insurance plan than general assistance medical care. In some cases, it would not be a good structure for them because there's other financing available to them, like Medicare financing. For example, somebody who has Medicare financing, like somebody who's an ESRD, they're not eligible for Minnesota care. So there's some examples there that just they're not simply eligible for it. Or somebody who's incarcerated does not make sense to provide for that transition. So there's some very good exceptions that were put into place the last 2 years to make sure that it fits, that the Minnesota Care program fits for the people in general assistance medical care that best can manage within that program.
Senator Sharon, the idea was that people who were in general assistance medical care for a short episodic type of visit would transition into Minnesota Care to give them a medical home. We had seen a lot of growth in the General Assistance Medical Care Program, and what we determined was that people were recycling. You know, they'd be in the program for an episodic visit, and then they'd get a little better, and they'd be working more, and their income would be too high, so they'd be off the program, and then they wouldn't have any health care, and so then they'd, whatever was their problem would flare up again, or they'd develop another problem, and then they'd be back in the program again. And so we were trying to move people that were in GMC on an episodic basis to transition them into Minnesota Care so that they would get a medical home and they would have a long-term medical, get their long-term care medical needs met. Not everybody is on general assistance medical care on an episodic basis. If you're homeless, if you have HIV, AIDS, or a number of categories that just didn't fit very well, and so they were not included in the transition.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there other questions? Okay, let's move on then. We've only got about 3 minutes left, so.
That's fine. And page 142 details the funding for general assistance medical care. Then the last thing I want to cover is the page 143, the other healthcare grants, and real quickly go over them to give you an idea as to what we've done in terms of other specialty grants. One is U Special Kids Grant, where University of Minnesota has a really unique program helping children with special needs provide care coordination and health services. And we've expanded that program in the past 2 years. The second one is the Oral Health Pilot, Oral Health Solutions Project, whereby we're trying to develop a new way of providing oral health care, dental services to our clients that's more effective in getting better access for our clients. Mental health and dental access is the biggest challenge for our clients at this point, the biggest challenge for maybe population in general. So we're trying to come up with other ways in which to provide access, better access to people who need dental care. And so we have a Oral Health Solutions Project that was funded by the legislature past couple of years. And we also have another unique arrangement down in Winona to increase dental access by providing incentives for dentists to provide, to see more people on our programs. And with that, Madam Chair, I would just simply, in terms of the administrative pieces, on pages 146, that begins the administrative budget pages, whereby we get we detail the allotment of how we provide services through administrative funding in those pages, following pages. And I'd be glad to. I'm not going to go through those, but I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have regarding those pages that follow in terms of how we finance our administrative activities within our administration. We have a total of $164 million towards administration, I believe the number is, and we have about 800 employees in the healthcare administration. Most of those employees are in our operations, either a claims operation or our Minnesota Care operations, we provide all the operational support for the other administrations, chemical and mental health, and for continuing care. We pay long-term care bills, for example. Some states have their own contract that out with an outside entity to pay claims. We have that in-house, and we have a very state-of-the-art and very capable group that does that and provides for claims processing and third-party recoveries and other things. And so a lot of this administrative money are in three categories, really. There's healthcare access fund money, there's general fund money, and there's federal money, and there's systems money. There's four categories. There's four sources for administrative support. And at some point, if you wish to go into that kind of detail, we can do that. But that kind of, we lay out in those following pages how we finance some of our activities.
Assistant Commissioner, including the expense that the counties have of doing eligibility for Medicaid, how much administrative cost as a percentage of our programs do we spend?
Madam Chair, We have not included that part. We should, maybe. The county
I think
costs.
It would only be a fair it way
would
to
be.
Look at it.
I would agree with that. That would be a fair part of this. Well, it's questions of apples and oranges. If you want to try to compare what we do in terms of what a health plan does, that's a one calculation. In terms of overall costs, we have $164 million administration, and we have a roughly $4 billion budget. So the math, that is what, about 4%? Less than that.
That does not include the county.
County does not include. What is that number, David?
4.1%.
Okay. Now, but if you want to start comparing what we do to what health plans do, if that's the nature of the question, that's a different calculation, and that's something that we would need to look at. But we do different things what a health plan does, much different things, and so that would be apples to oranges comparison. But in terms of overall administration of our programs, it's roughly, I guess, 4%. And again, remember, a lot of that supports other grants, you know, the long-term care grants, continuing care, and chemical and mental health. So we provide the infrastructure, the operations to support other funding too. So I guess that $4 billion should be higher. Actually, it should be much higher than that. So we can come up, if you want to look just at eligibility, though, because that eligibility cost of the counties have. In fact, if we want to look at just that part of it, we can come up with a calculation or estimate as to how much it costs to oversee our eligibility system. That's a separate exercise as well.
Well, I think some people would be interested in getting that information.
All right.